Chers auditeurs et auditrices, bienvenue à notre troisième épisode de la saison 2 du balado Annexe, intitulé « Art and Failures, quelle contribution à la discipline ». Aujourd'hui, je suis en compagnie de Hans Luan Torres, étudiant à la maîtrise en histoire de l'art de l'Université Concordia, et Elisabeth Otto, étudiante au doctorat en histoire de l'art de l'Université de Montréal. Bonjour à vous deux.
Bonjour Pascal.
Bonjour Pascal.
Donc, seulement vous préciser que pour ce troisième épisode, nous allons faire comme dans la saison 1, mettre à profit le côté bilingue du balado annexe. Mes questions seront posées en français et Elisabeth, je crois, pourra intervenir autant en français qu'en anglais, peut-être plus en anglais. Et pour Anne, ce sera majoritairement en anglais. Alors, pour commencer, ne serait-ce que pour situer nos auditeurs et auditrices, j'aimerais que vous me parliez un peu de votre sujet de recherche. Actuellement, il porte sur quoi? Donc, on va commencer avec toi, Hans.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hans. I am an MA student in the Department of Art History at Concordia University. And my MA research is on Canadian artist Jeffrey Farmer's practice. So over the past three decades, Jeffrey Farmer has developed this complex body of work that indulges in history, literature, pop culture, and personal memory to deconstruct and reassemble archives, images, and exhibition spaces. He has exhibited nationally and internationally at the most prestigious museums and art fairs, including Documenta in 2012 and the Venice Biennale in 2017. So he is, by all accounts, the definition of a successful artist. Some of the most prestigious and renowned art critics have acknowledged that his practice is about the passage of time, and some will go as far to say that his medium is time itself. And I agree with these observations, but I find that they don't talk about his practice fully, because in the process of deconstructing and reorganizing, he disrupts time and forms new and strange temporalities that result in a state of queerness. And I find that Farmer's work engages with queer temporality. And my thesis ultimately argues that queering is a project embedded in his overall practice. And so in my research, I look at his practice as a whole, but I focus on his often ignored early work, which began in the 1990s. And in looking at these beginnings, I found this large body of work that engages with gay advocacy, queerness, failure, and delay, these themes that don't really seem to apply to his work, but I trace them in his practice. And so I end up doing a queer reading of his overall body of work. And I find that allows for a richer understanding of his practice. I argue that his subjectivity informs his understanding of time and is at the root of this queering practice. And with that understanding, I look at his participation at the 2017 Venice Biennale, which happened at the same year as Canada 150. So the artist is asked to represent Canada during this very political moment. And the work in Venice is so personal. It's a reflection of his life, which includes his relationship to his family, including his grandfather and his husband. It kind of tells a story of queer progress. But I try to think through that and I ask, what does that do to the Canada Pavilion and by virtue, the nation state? You know, what is the conversation or where does the conversation between settler and Indigenous relations go in this political moment in this artistic platform? So I think through the complexities of queerness, whiteness, success and failure within national representation.
Et pour toi, Elisabeth?
Moi, je suis, comme tu as déjà mentionné, doctorante en histoire de l'art, en ce moment à la rédaction de ma thèse qui s'intitule Art Histories of Unlearning, Emily Carr and Gabriele Münter. Alors, il s'agit d'une étude comparatiste transnationale de l'icône de l'art canadienne Emily Carr et une contemporaine allemande, Gabriele Münter, qui est plus connue dans sa participation de la groupe de l'expressionnisme allemand de Chevalier Bleu, Blaue Reiter. Et je les compare ensemble dans leur corpus avant la Première Guerre mondiale, dans le contexte du primitivisme international. Beaucoup plus particulier, je regarde leur ambition professionnelle et artistique et comment ça s'articule dans un moment et la tension entre l'apprentissage et désapprentissage Comment c'est impossible de les apprendre quand on n'a pas accès à toutes les institutions d'apprentissage, les académies des beaux-arts notamment. Alors ça se joue dans cette tension et ça s'accroche à notre sujet d'aujourd'hui parce qu'il y a cette impossibilité pour cette génération des femmes artistes, mais aussi si on parle plus largement des femmes qui avaient des ambitions académiques, de cette impossibilité de devenir artiste, mais de cette grande quand même d'essayer de joindre leurs collègues masculins dans la discipline et tous les échecs qui ont été partout pour eux et le risque qu'ils ont pris et surtout les stratégies qu'ils ont inventées pour y arriver. Et le différent traitement de leurs sujets, des objets, de leur intérêt.
Pour connaître un petit peu votre parcours, comment vous en êtes venue à faire des études en histoire de l'art? Pourquoi avoir choisi cette discipline-là? Peut-être on pourrait commencer avec Hans?
Sure, I'll start. So I did a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Visual Arts. So I started pursuing an artistic practice that focused on photography and installation. But toward the end of my undergrad, I found that I enjoyed talking about art and thinking about it more than actually making it. I also found the aspect of making art to be a bit too revealing. And I thought that writing allowed you to have some more distance, but I've now realized that's not the case at all. In writing, you have to be somewhat more transparent. But with that, upon finishing my BFA, I did an extra year and got a minor in art history. And then I really enjoyed it. So I pursued a curatorial practice for a few years. And I felt I wanted to take the next step in my career, which meant doing an MA in art history. And I was really drawn to Concordia for their faculty and for the experience of being in Montreal. So I came to Montreal from British Columbia. And before that, I was living in Cusco, Peru, where I am from. And I just thought, I saw Montreal as this kind of utopia, in a way, a queer utopia, this mecca of art and culture. And so, the past 2.5, 3 years that I've been in this program have just been so revealing and so so exciting and a completely different experience that I've had, that I've experienced. So, yeah. But I also think, you know, art history allows you to think through all of these layers of history. And what I'm finding now is it's not just about how the past was constructed, but how we're building the future and what are the layers that we create and what are the implications that we are under right now in creating art and thinking about art and speaking about art?
I think my relationship to art history has changed over time. And in the beginning, I'm from Germany. I'm from a town called Regensburg, which is a medieval town with a lot of Gothic and Romanesque architecture. So I, without knowing, I was like soaked in art history from the start. So you kind of take this for granted. You live in it. So I, first of all, I undertook studies from business economics to philosophy, women and gender studies, archaeology, to finally end up in art history, and fell in love from my first seminar. And so it was in the beginning, I think, when I did my bachelor's in art history, aesthetic pleasure meets intellectual pursuit. And then when you endeavor more, and during my master's and my master thesis, when then research came in, I really developed this passion to not only know more, but then you realize that by researching in archives and really working with works of art and the material, artistic material and archival materials closely, you realize this is where you can develop new questions. And this is where I really, really found my passion for research. And then came to Montreal the first time during my master's. Was a master program that was directed towards international and transdisciplinary studies, where I for the first time also met the work of Emily Carr. But it's very interesting that I came as an international student for 10 months to Montreal, clearly, now that I'm looking back, clearly with a European German art historical view, working on Emily Carr, but then coming back for the doctorate and really living in Montreal and looking at the same time to British Columbia, where Emily Carr is from, and to Germany. I'm living and working this transnational perspective even more explicit, and really to realize that there is something like being in between national art histories and how complex things get once you are removed from your environment, and where things seem so clear, like Canadian art history has one story about Emily Carr and German art history has one story about Gabriele Münter. But then if you step out of that and if you look at both art histories, things get more complicated, but also more interesting. This is, in short, my relationship and story with art history.
Et une autre chose que je trouvais intéressante aussi par rapport à ton rapport à l'histoire de l'art dans ta présentation pour la participation au balado, c'est que tu posais la question, puis c'est vraiment très connecté avec la thématique d'aujourd'hui qui est Art and Failures, quelle contribution à la discipline. Il y avait cette question du Why Unlearning Now que tu posais, et j'aimerais ça vous entendre sur qu'est-ce qui se passe historiquement parlant ou artistiquement parlant, pour qu'il y ait vraiment un momentum pour ce désir d'apprendre différemment ou d'enseigner différemment l'histoire de l'art, ou du moins d'écrire et de réfléchir l'histoire de l'art différemment.
Well, I will start and then we get into our conversation. I think the every master student already or PhD at one point is realizing, once he or she is asked to write art history herself, about the difficulties to really decide for one storyline that you have to defend in your defense of your thesis, and where you are in the overall art historical story and stories. And this is, I think, the first thing that you learn, that there are different art histories, and thank God more and more so, and that we are now in a time where we realize there are multiple realities, multiple art histories, and we have to think about how those art histories speak to each other, how they are not speaking to each other, and where we are falling short to also reflect on different realities. And I think this year, due to the pandemic, but also a lot of coinciding, I mean, here in Canada, we are so close to the American politics, the Black Lives Matter movement, where a lot of difficulties and discussions that are been ongoing since the last 50 years are now really urgent to such a degree that they cannot be ignored, and in no discipline. I think this is the point where it penetrates all institutions, universities, museums, all places of society. And I think we cannot hide behind our research topics, because every research topic reflects a certain reality, and we have to position, as people writing these histories, we have to position ourselves in relationship to these realities.
Yeah, I think, thinking through art history, you realize that there is this hegemonic understanding of history. And as Elizabeth, you mentioned, there's these alternatives to history, but you, in seeing those, you see who has been included and who and what is excluded to build this history, these narratives, and in thinking about failure, how is that mobilized within our history or in history in general? Because we're in this capitalist society, we're taught that we have to follow this lineage of success, or that is the story that you often paint with any sort of narrative. Actually on the opposite end, failure in relation to art is kind of like this over-dramatized moment. You know, you see this a lot with biographies or movies about artists where they have to endure this like pain and suffering in order to become this successful being. But the in-betweenness is kind of lost in all cases.
That's true. And we've already been talking about that before. This also the self-fashioning, like that you even have to comply with this myth of the artist that has to go through a period of neglect and being forgotten just to be rediscovered again by an art historian, by society, and or by the art market, which is the the place where you finally are valorized and valued, and where your art historical value is reflected. And we have been seen with cases like Hilma af Klint that there is a connection between not happening on the art market and also not happening in art history, because if there's no works of you to buy or to collect, then you cannot be shown in private or public collections and nobody can discover you or write about you. And if you have no access to private foundations or bodies of work, then you're not existing. And then you, this is really, then you realize that it really, we have a huge responsibility as people writing history, if it's art history or history with a big H, and you realize that despite all the efforts, I mean, we're speaking about 50 years, there's a new edition, 50 years of Linda Nochlin's seminal text, Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? And we're still grappling with this question, and it's still relevant. The same goes with queer theory. Like, it's also been around for 30 years, correct me if I'm wrong. And how difficult is it, and how many reiterations we need, and we have to bring these questions up and up again, not to solve them, but to really bring them forward and to advance our field.
Oui, d'ailleurs, un des points que je trouvais super intéressant dans ta présentation, Hans, c'était relié à ton approche queer du travail, justement, de Jeffrey Farmer. Et tu précisais que c'était un angle avec lequel le travail de l'artiste, une approche qui n'était pas nécessairement appliquée au travail de l'artiste. Et je te disais que ça m'étonnait parce que je trouvais que c'était une facette importante dans son travail. Et aussi, tu as abordé la question de la mise en scène de l'échec aussi dans le travail de Jeffrey Farmer. Donc, je serais intéressée de t'entendre à ce propos concernant ta vision de ton approche queer du travail de Jeffrey Farmer. Qu'est-ce que ça révèle de différent et de peut-être des œuvres dans lesquelles il a justement stagé is failure.
It's very interesting. I think in thinking about success, does that narrative fit? You know, does this queer narrative fit within his work? Because he's not shy about it. He speaks about it very clearly whenever he's interviewed or even in all of his text work that accompanies his installations. You know, he talks about his subjectivity. But it's very strange. People don't really pick up on it. Or if they do, it's this sort of quick footnote or a quick acknowledgement. But they don't think about it critically. Why is that? I'm not too sure. I think, I'm still working through that. why is that ignored within his work when it's so obvious? And yeah, I'm not sure.
Do you think it has something to do with, for example, once you're shown in the Canadian Pavilion, you're considered a Canadian artist representing a whole country that is so diverse and complex and many layers of history and ethnic and cultural groups. So you have to be one for all, for everybody. Do you think that's why perhaps the aspects of his work that are less, I don't know, common for so-called Canadian society are a bit like toned down?
Yes, I think his work is often ignored by critics. The queerness in his work is often ignored by critics, but one of the reasons why I think that's the case is because his work is so complicated. You know, there's so many layers that are embedded within his work. There's a staging aspect of his work, the installation aspect of it, the materiality aspect of it. If you are familiar with his work, he often cuts out these magazines or collection of magazines or books. So there's so much to engage with in those conversations. And I think in all of the discussions about his work, the subjectivity and sexuality aspect of it are at the very bottom and they're often ignored. But I think, or what I'm finding in my research is that's actually at the root of his work. You know, that's where it stemmed from at the very beginning, at least. And I see that being the narrative and the thread that ties his work together is, you know, this experience that he had, or these experiences that he had in his youth of feeling like an outsider or an other because of his sexuality. That sort of is something that he extrapolates and creates and recreates in his work. And you also see that later in his better known body of works, these queer beings, these puppets, or this disruption in time, this failure of time. These are all these little narratives that show up, but they're not really discussed at length, if at all. But I think they're so important in his work.
What I realized is, and this is where historic cases help really realizing patterns also in artist rewriting, is that when you look at, for example, Emily Carr or Gabriele Münter, and you look at their critique, since Emily Carr died in 1945, Gabriele Münter in the 60s, so we have a good 70 to 60 years of critique since their death, and you realize that they changed after also the needs of the respective art history. So there is a time when Emily Carr is an important Canadian artist, the icon, the feminine icon of Canadian modernism. Then she's the darling of feminist art history, of early ecological endeavors, of also criticized for her appropriation of First Nations design. So there are needs depending on time that are answered by artists. So there is a change of fortune critique. Also what the respective art history needs at this time, also to renew themselves, to reject, to include, to exclude. And I think right now we also are in a period where there's a lot of very critical thinking. And I think this is also lived out in museums now, where museums look at their collection and from 2021 perspective and really like thinking hard, can we show this person looking at their worldviews, just as a keyword talking about racism, for example. And I think we need to really sharpen our critical toolbox also, to because we are asked, do you think this or that artist should be continued to be shown? And I think it's not an easy question, because it conflates the needs of critique of the society today and a historic worldview, a personal, an individual that had been working and living in another historical time. And these are tough questions to answer today, I find.
Est-ce que vous trouvez ça difficile d'avoir à composer avec la notion d'échec, justement, en tant que chercheur, chercheuse?
If we're thinking about school, and particularly an MA program, this program that's supposed to, by all means, teach you how to be a master of something, a master of art history, you're put in this temporality of a student, and there's parameters to it. You know, it's a 2-year program. You get through it, and you're kind of pushed into this next step of a PhD, and then you are this doctor of art. And whatever that means. But I think in thinking about that, it's again this narrative of success or building you to succeed. But what happens when you fail at that? And I think, you know, 2020 brought in this moment of failure for a lot of people. We're kind of going through this collective failure. For me, particularly as a student, I've had to take an extra semester, actually an extra year, to just finish my thesis because I needed a bit more time to just pause. I found the moment 2020 was so close to my research and thinking about queer temporality and disrupting time. So it was a bit too much for me that I needed to kind of pause. What does it mean to refuse or to fail at this moment in time for myself personally? I've kind of rethought that, and I found I've used this time to really think about putting the theories that I'm looking at into practice and seeing where that takes me and what I'm able to gather from that. And I think it's easier said than done, for sure. But, Elizabeth and I, we both kind of picked on Jack Halberstam's book, The Queer Art of Failure. And there's so many gems and morsels of knowledge to kind of pick from in that book about, you know, what happens when you fail, what are the lessons in failure, in queer failure in particular. And so, yeah, I found that to be really, to be positioned in a very interesting time.
Yeah, failure, I mean, during a PhD, which takes several years, failure is a constant threat. And especially when it's about writing and the writing process in itself, but also as the last exercise that you do within the institution of academia, where you need a legitimization of your work, you inscribe yourself into an already existing framework, and at the same time you try to think it anew, you try to ask new questions, you try to apply new methods. So you're always on the verge of failing and success, and of course success is measured by reality, that is your discipline, by institutions that ask you to jump certain hoops and to produce a result that can be published. But for that you need peers. You need peers to confirm the legitimacy of your subject. It is a very precarious position of your discipline in terms of this intellectual exercise, but also, as Hans said, also the life of a master's or PhD student is precarious, and reflecting that also in our lived reality. So to think about failure is very liberating, and for me a little bit similar to Hans's reaction is really the salvation, I think, is really to go back to the work and the works. For me, it's really to remind myself when I'm hung up in the immensity of this, okay, I have to do justice to my topic, I go back to the artist and I remind myself And this is what I'm writing about their risk of failure they took. And I'm writing about their artistic education, about their professional ambitions in 1913. And to really see, okay, I can find myself in it. I can think with that about today, but also I'm thinking in historical terms. And I do try to do justice to them. I think this is equally important as to do justice to our current moment in time. But I think this theme is something very universal and transhistoric. And this is, I think, why it's speaking so much to us. And especially also, like, if you could talk about queer art history and the inclusion of diversity, and this is clashing with the standards of academia. There are efforts to change that and to open up, and also in museums to be more inclusive. But this is my claim. And Hans, you can tell me what you think about it. I think it's impossible if you don't change the institution itself to just live in this idea of inclusion, like in terms of adding subjects, subject matters, themes, people to an existing framework.
I think especially last year, you know, after June and July, there were all these calls to action for museums and art organizations to be more inclusive and to take drastic steps in reorganizing themselves. And so now that we're coming a year into that, we're gonna see which ones succeed in that way and which ones have failed, and what happens to those that fail to meet this moment that is so urgent. I don't know what the response will be, and if it is possible to be diverse in what is being asked of that word, because there's so much implications actually in that. I think, especially in, if you think about museums and institutions, you're asking them to give up so much power of themselves that they benefit from, you know. Institutions are built upon structures of whiteness. And so if you're going to restructure that and change it, what's going to happen with them, and how are they going to respond to that? Are people at that level of making that commitment? That's something that I don't really know.
Il y a cette facette-là aussi dans la façon de désapprendre, dans le unlearning, qui est déstabilisant parce que tu as besoin de repenser toutes tes bases. C'est ce qui me motive à me réimpliquer aussi dans ma discipline qui est l'histoire de l'art, parce que je suis en train de la voir changer. Et moi, j'ai envie de participer de ce changement-là. Donc, je sais pas vous si c'est quelque chose, si le changement ou c'est quelque chose qui vous insécurise ou...
Moi, je trouve ça stimulant aussi. Moi, je trouve ça... C'est pour ça, je pense qu'il y a une raison pourquoi je travaille sur le désapprentissage. Et je pense, dans un terme général, c'est le défi de se vraiment... de vivre avec une incertitude sans déjà penser à l'avantage de surmonter ça, parce que c'est vraiment, il faut sauter vers cette incertitude, que c'est pour ça aussi, je pense, j'ai répondu à l'appel du balado et de cette question, pourquoi désapprendre maintenant, parce que c'est là où ça se joint, la volonté de désapprendre et notre situation où on est un peu, maintenant, si on est forcé de sauter, c'est moins agréable que si on fait ça volontairement. Bon, en tout cas, on saute dans un inconnu, et le seul espoir qu'on peut avoir, qu'à un moment, qu'on découvre des nouvelles méthodes, des nouvelles façons de faire, on se rappelle des choses qu'on a connues. Et après, intégrer le nouveau et l'ancienne dans quelque chose qui prend une autre forme. Je pense que ça pourrait être l'espoir aussi, c'est pour la discipline. Je pense pas assez radical de dire qu'il faut jeter tout. Et je pense pas que c'est le désapprentissage. Je pense pas. C'est plutôt comme de se rappeler quelque chose qu'on a appris aussi inconsciemment. C'est aussi un peu ça. C'est comme apprendre un nouvel langage, une deuxième, une troisième langue. Et à un moment, on fait des liens entre les langues. On parle aussi trois langues en même temps. Et il y a un moment de mécompréhension, mais aussi là, le moment où on peut inventer de nouveaux mots, tisser des nouveaux liens. Comme ça, ça devient beaucoup plus trois-dimensionnel, quatre-dimensionnel, cinq-dimensionnel. Alors, c'est beaucoup plus élastique. Sinon, si on pense juste de passer le futur, on reste dans le deux-dimensionnel. Il y a juste deux directions. Et on sort pas de ce paradigme du progrès, en fait. Si on pense même le désapprentissage dans un esprit du progrès, je doute que ça a le même résultat. Et vraiment, cet élément innovateur qu'on souhaite à réaliser avec ça. Isn't it, Pascal, je me demande aussi... qu'on parle de l'échec et de prendre l'échec comme une chance et de vraiment le prendre au sérieux ou des apprentissages, que ce n'est pas aussi un geste politique et en sorte qui doit aussi, il faut se demander en quoi l'histoire de l'art peut aussi avoir un côté activiste. Et comment vivre son activisme.
Ça vient de soi, mais en même temps, c'est ça, la limite, elle est où? Jusqu'où on s'en va dans l'activisme? Ou est-ce qu'on dépasse nos lignes? Ou est-ce qu'on doit... Puis jusqu'où aussi on prend position, je veux dire, personnellement? Jusqu'où on implique... justement, on abordait la question de la forme que doit prendre une thèse ou de la forme... que doit prendre l'écriture, ne serait-ce qu'une thèse, où on doit se dégager, on ne peut pas l'écrire au jeu, comment on implique la communauté aussi dans nos réflexions. Donc ça aussi, c'est une position à prendre comme chercheur, chercheuse, j'ai l'impression.
I don't know. I think in regards to unlearning, which was the conversation that was had earlier, you know, my experience is a bit different as a racialized settler of color. Like, there's things that I'm just learning about, and I guess my positionality within art history comes at a bit of at a different angle, because I'm not looking through at myself through whiteness, but I'm looking at whiteness from the outside. That's something that I'm working through within my research, is my positionality within that. So it's not so much a relearning, but more of where I'm gonna take this as my career or my research develops. And then in regards to activism in art history, you know, I think, again, just being myself and my interests, like, that's always been at the forefront. Art has, and nowadays it's so hard to argue, like, that art isn't political. Everything that you do is in art is political, because it's a platform that you're giving something, whether it's a thought or someone in particular, and that means something. And usually what art does, it's, you know, it's at the very forefront of the next thing or where we are culturally and in within history. So I think it's very important to think about the developments that happen within art and what are the politics that are integrated in art, because that you see that ripple into other facets of culture and life.
Yes, it is important that we give a platform, but also, like, it's today it's us that we can amplify voices of the artists we've chosen to amplify, but we have also privilege that our voices are heard in our peer group. And I think this is important also to acknowledge that how we are positioned in academia to do this. And this is a very fortunate position. You can think that further if your research project is supported by a research grant, et cetera, which is acknowledged by a certain national society and funded. So, and these are movements, political movements, economical reasons that also facilitate certain discourses and inhibit other discourses. So I think we have to be honest and also if you look back in history, these discourses change and other topics were favored and this will also change in the future. And I think what we can do, and I think also a podcast like this and talking about it with each other is helping to create a transparency. Also, if there's more exchange between university and museums and institutions and research institutions, to make it also transparent how our own domain is working and how we are part of it and what we could do, what you could imagine if you would work more together. I think this is, could be a nice, I don't know, learning effect to learn from activism.
I think in thinking about transparency, it comes down to the politics of art. You know, what are the structures that we are currently working with and working through? And who do those favor and who are affected by them? Because I think, you know, to dismantle them as a whole is such a utopic idea. But is that a possibility? And if it isn't, which arguably it isn't, then how can we work through this? How can we exist now, you know? But also thinking about, again, 2020 as this moment of the restructuring, and because people have had to just do that with your doors closed, you have to think of different ways to engage your audience. So that opens up the possibility of changing your approach to art or just to programming, not even your content, but how you explain and talk about art. So we'll see what happens. It's kind of a big question mark currently as the world constantly changes drastically every day.
Moi, je trouve déjà le mot échec, quand chaque fois quand ce mot te vient dans l'esprit, c'est déjà une invitation à penser selon qui. C'est un échec selon qui. Ça dévoile déjà une manière qu'on est tellement habitué à penser dans cette binarité d'échec et succès. Et ça ouvre déjà la porte de repenser sa vie autrement. Je pense que c'est bottom line, c'est ça. Et à partir de ça, beaucoup est possible.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, if we think about success and failure as binaries, we think that success is like the achievement and that it's the end goal and there's so much happiness in success. But if you are a successful artist, you know, if we think about it in that way, there is so much pressure to maintain that and to continue that on. And of course, yes, you have, you know, there's wealth and accolades and access that you're given when you are successful and privileges in so many ways. But again, it's very taboo to think about like the difficulties of that. But also like how failure is framed. I think, for instance, with Jeffrey Farmer's work, his most well-known project, which was a documenta in 2012 called Leaves of Grass, this installation of these images that he cut out from a collection of Life magazine. This work that was kind of accidental. He was supposed to present something different. The project, The Surgeon and the Photographer, was supposed to be the show that, or the work that he showed. But the lighting and the space wasn't fit for it. He was at the new gallery in their long corridor. And so he had to rethink what to do. And so that's where this idea for Leaves of Grass came. And in an interview that he gave when he was reflecting on his career, he actually framed Leaves of Grass, or he initially saw it as a failure, because by the time it was done, he cut up all of these works or all of these images, and he was $50,000 in debt because he had to hire assistants and taking these things. You know, there was so much that he had to do to get this project done. And so he felt it was a failure, but it was read as such a success. It's this brilliant depiction of time and the history of humanity in this particular moment between 1935 to 1985. So yeah, how is failure framed in art history, and how, what does it contribute to? What is in the narrative of success? Is that hidden or is that part of it? And why isn't it acknowledged? I don't know. I'm really curious to know, in your research with Emily Carr, you know, what is her relation to failure?
I mean, in the case of Emily Carr, since she wrote her own biography, since 1937, she started writing once her health started to decline. She became a writer, and in English Canada, a lot of people know her more for her writing than for her visual art. So she gave her own version of her story. And of course, she was building on her failure in 1913, the period I'm writing about, where she had finished her first trip along the west coast of British Columbia and painting, I think, 120 oil paintings of First Nations sites that she wanted to sell to the British Columbian government, because she heard that they wanted to open up a museum, and she thought she, in the belief that the First Nations of this region would disappear, so at least there would remain paintings of it. But she fell into a period, first of all, the First World War began, the funds were declining, and an anthropologist was judging her work as not enough accurate to the sites, and anyways too expressionist in its style. So, and she was interpreting this as a failure. So in her own storytelling, in her own fashioning of her life story, 15 years that followed, where she was having several jobs, she was becoming a landlady, she was doing pottery, she was struggling, was presented as a failure, whereas that we know that the reaction to her exhibition 1913 was not that bad as she presented it, because when she's writing her life story, there is 1927, where she was, so to speak, rediscovered. She was shown with artists from the Group of Seven in this seminal exhibition, Northwest Coast Art, Native and Modern. So where she had her comeback and the strongest period, and where she during her lifetime had the most attention. So it's only in retrospect sometimes that failure is acknowledged to write a beautiful story arc with an happy ending in the end. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's really used, failure is used as this momentum of change, of a twist or a turn, to just have the comeback of the hero or heroine in the end. And this is so interesting. And Halberstam says that, you know, success is sometimes this this idea of you try, you fail, but you try again, and then you succeed. It's this story that we are so used to.
Yeah.
And to think failure in this tension between success is difficult, and it can be a trap, because we're not really used to think through deconstruction.
Yeah, I think, like, what I'm understanding in our conversation and trying to think about this moment in art history, I think it's about identity and the relationship of identity and failure and success. Like, as you said, that's kind of the orientation or the directions that we're kind of positioned in between. Which way are we going to go? I'm also really interested in this positionality, as we kind of touched on a little bit, because we're both outsiders in this discussion of Canadian identity, but we're looking at these Canadian icons, you know, these or Canadian artistic icons. And so I'm thinking through right now, like, where am I in this narrative? I'm looking at Canada and its structure as a nation, but also its problems. Then I'm also thinking about this artist and where does he come in that dialogue? And how do I speak about that as I'm someone who is kind of separate in a way? Yes and no. That's difficult to say. I'm in it, but from a different perspective. I'm curious to know about how you are navigating this discussion about nationality in art.
I mean, it's the period that I'm working on, modernism, is very much, nationalism is very on the forefront. You have German expressionism, you have French impressionism. So there's always a nation attached to certain styles and said to be responsible for also the rayonnement, the in certain style. When I arrived in Canada, I came as a German art historian. Now, after so many years in Montreal, I see myself and the art history I'm doing more differentiated, and I even make a difference between, I wouldn't call myself a Canadian art historian, but, you know, perhaps a Montreal art historian, because there's a difference between how one in Vancouver looks at Emily Carr and in Montreal. Nevertheless, I'm positioning myself from where I'm coming from, but I don't have this. It's interesting. I wouldn't consider myself a settler, because Hans, you said you gave your identification and you call yourself
settler of color.
Settler of color.
Settler, yeah.
It's very interesting. I'm really very formed by my European, German training and thinking in historical terms, whereas I've learned that history in Canada is very much written on a geographical basis, that I'm thinking when I'm working on my historical cases and case studies, I'm thinking in historical terms, and I'm looking closely at the historical context and try to decipher that. So I think I'm a hybrid now. The métissage canadien a bien fonctionné avec moi. I think and this was also the goal, I think, coming here without knowing it. Once I came with a European perspective that now is transformed through all the knowledge and the experience in Canadian academia, so that I'm not the same anymore looking back towards Canada, towards Germany. So I'm looking to Germany from an outsider perspective now. And it is not fitting anymore. To come back to your question, it doesn't fit in any national ideas of art history.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were talking about locations previously. I think my positionality, and I guess this kind of new identity that I present myself with as a racialized settler or a settler of color, is based on where I'm at right now and the context of my research. You know, it's where I'm positioning my point of view from. And I think that's so important with any sort of research, because that is, again, being transparent about your biases and where you're coming from. And I think I see that in the artist that I'm researching and his work. He is very much affected by his place. You know, he grew up in Vancouver, and the work that he was doing in Vancouver in the early 90s was very much influenced by film. And Vancouver has this now new history of being a Hollywood North. That's where a lot of films are filmed. and Then he moved in the later part of his career in the 2000s. He's traveling around and showing in places like the Louvre and in Berlin and these European places. And his work is affected by that. He starts looking at these European histories and he's deconstructing them and reassembling them. And what I find interesting now with him is that he is, after the Venice Biennale, he decided to move to Hawaii and Kauai, one of the islands there. And that particular island has so much history because that's where Captain Cook first arrived and made contact with Hawaiians there. So I think going forward, if that's where he is based, you know, his identity as a settler, as a white settler, is going to be very important and part of the dialogue within his work. I think also in regard, I find it so interesting that we're both talking about these artists that come from British Columbia and the histories of British Columbia. And usually British Columbia is kind of situated outside of the dialogues of Canadian art. You know, a lot of the movement that we see is usually happening in Quebec and Ontario or Toronto. But yeah, I find it so interesting. And now being back in British Columbia and seeing what the art world is here, the community of art, I find it very fascinating to look at it or to finish this research from this perspective and where I'm located. One thing that I wish we could have talked about a little bit more was this idea of queer temporality, because I think it applies to both of the artists that we're looking at as ourselves in this current moment. So queer temporality is this failure to meet this linear time that humans are kind of designed to follow. This idea of, you know, you're born, you go to school, you get married, you have children, you raise them, and then you die. And then you build this genealogy, inheritance to pass on to your children, and then they pass it on to their children. So it's this linear move that we all are kind of built to follow. But what I find so fascinating with Jeffrey Farmer is at the start of his career, he kind of takes this a stance kind of against it. You know, his birth name is Jeffrey Topham, and that's how he was going by at the start of his career. And that's his paternal last name. But he gives that up once he graduates and takes on his maternal last name, Farmer. And so this change of identity, again, identity, allows for this queer temporality that he's kind of exploring and using within his work. And when I think about Emily Carr, you know, someone who didn't have children, who didn't, or even just any female artist who chooses not to follow in these heteronormative paths, I think it's failing this normativity that we're all supposed to work under and what that opens up creatively, but also personally. I find that very fascinating.
Eh bien, c'était très intéressant d'échanger, surtout dans le contexte actuel de pandémie, à propos de l'art et l'échec.
Definitely. Oh, such a fruitful conversation. I think those are the questions that I'm dealing with right now as I finish this this thesis, because yeah, there's so much complexity that's tied to it. So thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Je vous remercie beaucoup d'avoir participé à cet épisode. Merci beaucoup pour votre temps.
Merci beaucoup, Pascal.
Thank you, Pascal.